Hi, everybody. Today, Thursday, August 14th, 2025, and our friends, Richard Wolf and Michael Hodson, are back with us. Welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Let me start, Michael, with you. You believe that Donald Trump is going to the meeting to declare war on Russia instead of making deal with Russia. What's your point in that?
Well, Trump has been love bombed, or I should say hate bombed, in the last few days by the European anti-Russia NATO leaders, who had a big meeting with him on Wednesday, saying that they have convinced him not to be Putin's puppet, and that if Trump does not succeed in arranging a ceasefire, that Trump will simply walk away. And Trump has said already before this hate bombing that he'll tell in the first 2 minutes that whether Russia is going to be amenable to his proposals for a ceasefire or not. And if Russia's not, he's going to simply walk out. Well, what this means is that Trump expects Russia to probably walk out and the meeting to be a failure. And Trump is trying to prepare the ground to say, it's not me, it's Russia that wouldn't listen to the message from NATO, from Congress. And basically, the last few days have seen Merz and Starmer and Macron and von der Leyen pull the rug out from anything Trump can offer for a ceasefire by saying, there's not going to be a ceasefire. We are going to continue to fight against Russia, no matter what the United States does. We're going to continue to be supplying the Ukrainian army. Zelensky has said, we and the Azov battalion are going to continue to fight against Russia, even if Trump sells us out. We're going to fight. Congress has said we are going to prevent any agreement with Russia to give away, to recognize Russia's Russian speakers as being part of Russia. So they've already said that Trump has zero authority to make any substantive agreement at all. And I think what the newspapers are not talking about, and I think what we can talk about today, is, you know, why is Russia going to this? If it has people reading the newspapers, and it must see what's happening. Well, I think that Putin's foreign policy aide, Yuri Viktorovich, gave a summary of the agenda for Friday's meeting. And he said that although the immediate occasion for this is Ukraine's fighting, he said, quote, Putin and Trump will discuss bilateral cooperation in the economic sphere and issues of global security. In other words, what Russia wants to do is say, let's not talk about Ukraine at all. We'll agree to disagree there, but let's talk about what we can possibly agree on is relevant for both. Well, what does this mean for Russia? Well, it means reversing the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear arms control agreement. Russia can say, no matter what, we don't want a fight between the United States and Russia to occur. If there is a fight, it's going to be, if Europe wants to fight, let Europe fight us, and we'll fight Europe, but no matter what, if there's mutual bombing, which is what looks likely, if Europe really tries to fight Russia. And remember, Europe has no weapons left, virtually. It has one weapon, missiles, including atomic missiles. So that is what essentially Europe is saying. We're going to fight Russia. The only arms we have are missiles to attack Russia. Putin has already said, if any missile hits us from a European country, we're not going to fight against Ukraine. Ukraine is only the arena for the war between NATO and Russia. Even if the missile is a U.S. missile, if it's been sold to Germany or Britain and it's become a British or German missile, we'll retaliate by bombing the military sites in Europe. But let's make it clear that this is not going to trigger a war with America. I think that's their number one feeling. And the second, what's another global issue they want to talk about? They want to reaffirm the Monroe Doctrine. The Monroe Doctrine said that Europe cannot interfere with American affairs, and in exchange, America will not interfere with European affairs and the sphere of influence. And I think the concern of Russia right now is Azerbaijan and Armenia, where Trump has tried to create a road that will block the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative, will block Russian transportation there.
And North-South Corridor.
Yes, yes. And I'm reminded of, we're really going back to the Khrushchev-Kennedy showdown over Cuba over 60 years ago. And all of the importance of the Azerbaijan road is, it's really part of Turkey's sphere of influence there and Turkish power. Well, remember how the Cuban Missile Crisis was settled. Khrushchev agreed to withdraw the missiles from Cuba, and the Kennedy agreed to withdraw the missiles from Turkey. It was even at that time, the fight of that whole area, Turkey, the Caucasus, the Black Sea, the neighboring area, this goes back over 60 years. Russia wants to try to remind Trump that this is what the Monroe Doctrine was all about. And finally, it means Trump telling the European hardliners that if they attack Russia, that NATO is a defensive alliance. America is not required to come to the aid of any country that is attackers. Trump may say that Ukraine is attacked, but in this case, Ukraine is the result of the coup d'etat that the United States itself and NATO mounted in 2015. It's Russia is going to try to convince Trump that it's Russia that is under attack and is the victim of attack, not Ukraine. Ukraine is the attacker on the Russian speakers. I guess your audience doesn't need me to emphasize that, but Russia is going to try to explain, and Russia, that means that it, not only Putin, but Lavrov is also there. They're going to try to explain what the Russian point of view is. And they will present this meeting as saying, let's not think of coming to any territorial agreement on Ukraine. This is going to be settled on the battlefield. And Trump is going to say, well, I want Ukraine to be a part of this meeting. I think Russia will say, absolutely, we want Ukraine to and its leader to be part of any peace agreement. And within the next year, we will defeat the Ukrainian army. We will replace the government of Zelensky with a Ukrainian party that is against the war with Russia, according to all of the polls. And we will certainly have the new Ukrainian government sitting at the table. So you're absolutely right. We need the Ukrainians to have an agreement with all of this. Zelensky's not the Ukrainian head. Zelensky has abolished any kind of democratic freedom there. He's ruling as by fiat. The Ukrainian people are threatened by the gangs of army recruiters that are seizing Ukrainians off the street, sending them to the front line to get killed within 24, 48 hours if they don't defect. So I think that's what the Russian meeting will all about. And the question is, Trump doesn't have any Russian specialists advising him. The CIA has gotten rid of all of the specialists who even understand the Russian position that I've just described. And the question is whether there will be a breakdown and whether Trump will be able to pay attention to this and have any ability to at least understand the Russian position. That's all that Russia can hope for in all of this.
Yeah. Richard, how do you feel about it? Do you think that Donald Trump would be able to break a deal, cut a deal, or as Michael said, you're not that much optimistic about it?
I never understood the what strikes me as nonsense about Mr. Trump and deals. He seems remarkably poor at making deals. What he can do is use the power that the positions he acquires give him. He seems to know how to do that well. And he has, and I have to give him credit, welded together a remarkable coalition. So he can put coalitions together, but making deals among them, other than, here, join the coalition because I'm going to give you this. So let's just review that, and then I'll get to the meeting in Anchorage in Alaska. In order to win, the leaders of either the Republican or Democratic Party, since they are both beholden to the business community, the employer class in this country, and have been for many, many decades, they have to get from that community large sums of money, now counted in the billions, if not tens of billions of dollars for each electoral cycle. Okay, they do that. What do they do with the money? Answer, they put together coalitions of various groups of the population with the same objective, get them to vote. If you're the Republican businessmen and women, get them to vote for the Republican. If you're the Democratic businessmen and women donors, get them to vote for the Democrat. And by now, we're quite familiar with who the coalition partners are. The deals were made long before Mr. Trump arrived on the scene. The Republicans cut no deal now. They just continue. They are the party that throws money and opportunities and lots of symbols at what? We know them, right? Fundamentalist Christians. White supremacists, people in love with their guns, people who hate immigrants. I could collect a few more, but you know, it's familiar. And on the Democratic side, who? Better educated people, women, non-white people, and that's what they do. And the elections are assigned, outcomes depend on who's a bit more effective one year than the other, either in getting the money. Look at Elon Musk throwing $200 to $300 million at Mr. Trump to counteract whatever Kamala Harris might have achieved otherwise, etc. And the election is decided by 1, 2, 3% of the vote. Trump has no mandate. If he had one, maybe he could talk that he took this conventional arrangement one step further. He made a deal, but he didn't. He didn't take it one step further at all. His vote is the same tweedledum, tweedledee oscillation that we have always seen. And I think that the Russians know it. So when we get to the meeting in Alaska, I want to underscore, if anything, go further than what Michael said. I don't think it's got anything to do with Ukraine. And the reason is that the issue of Ukraine has been resolved. The Ukraine lost and Russia won. End of story. We might wish it to be otherwise, but it is silly to keep pretending. Time is on the Russian side. every day the Russian army moves a certain number of kilometers westward. The West loves to say they're not doing it as fast as they had hoped. Who the hell knows? The West doesn't know. And whether it's true or not doesn't matter. The line of direction is obvious, unrelentingly obvious. By this point, to pretend that it's otherwise shows that you're not in touch anymore with what's going on. You are so upset by the reality that you have shifted over into make-believe. Therefore, the Ukrainian issue should be left exactly the way it is the Russian true, the Russians could save the lives and the expense of another 6 months or 12 months of war. But look, the reality is, again, that going to war has increased the rate of economic growth in Russia compared to what it was before the war. In other words, this war is doing for the Russian economy what World War II did for the depressed American economy. We shouldn't be surprised at that as a possible outcome. That's what all of Keynesian economics teaches us. Massive government intervention, whether it's for war or growing flowers, has a stimulative effect. And it has done that in Russia. Their problem is a bit of inflation, not a bit of collapse. Do the Russians have their economic problems? Of course they do. And if you're a child, you'll cherry pick a few statistics of where they're having trouble and say, the way a lot of people are these days, Mr. Trump, be aware that the Russian economy is in terrible. That's not true. The repetition of that doesn't make it true. The failure to show it makes it false. So Mr. Putin will be there. And he's not interested in Ukraine. He understands that's the game. That's what we talk about. And why? Because that's what Mr. Trump wants. Lost in all of this is that it's now crystal clear that the United States has been for months pushing for this meeting. They want a summit. That's the political theater they want to stage. Mr. Trump knows that he's winning. Everyone else in the world who pays attention and who is not the leader of a European country whose entire career has been saying yes to America against first the Soviet Union and now Russia. What Mr. Trump faces is a Russia that has a completely different agenda. And there, Michael was exactly right. They want arms control treaties. They want peaceful resolution of hotspots in the world that might lead to conflict, such as the Middle East, such as the Caucasus Mountains, if the United States is going to start making trouble there, et cetera, et cetera. And the final point, the reason that's the agenda of the Russians and why they might be willing to say, yes, let's have a ceasefire. We'll have a meeting in October to go over the specifics of the longer it takes, the better their position and the weaker the Ukrainians and the silly Europeans who don't understand you can't have a sustained foreign policy of hostility to Russia as you're losing your own people to support it. And the final point, the whole world understands there's a shift going on away from the United States, away from Europe, toward Asia, number one, and the global South, number two. And all of this is playing around because you can't stop it, because you can't control it, because the people who are winning, the global South, know it, and the people in the global North are still busy denying it. As long as you have that situation, they're going to stretch this out. Of course they are. That is their best strategy. And that will govern whatever happens in the poor, unfortunate country of Ukraine, about whom neither side gives a flying you know what.
Well, Richard,
we know that Donald Trump yesterday was repeating that they want, you mentioned as well, that they want ceasefire in Ukraine. And you look at the way that Europeans are talking about it. Zelensky wants ceasefire. Everybody on the part of the West wants ceasefire in Ukraine. On the part of Russians, what does that mean, in your opinion, for the economy of Russia, for what's going on in Ukraine, for what's going on? Is the ceasefire the same, has the same sort of meaning for Russia? It's the just somehow putting an end to the conflict temporarily and just making some moves on Ukraine, improving the Ukrainian army or sending more weapons to Ukraine to go against Russia again. What does that mean when they're asking about the ceasefire, Michael?
Well, I don't think there's any chance of Europe sending either troops to Ukraine or even weapons, because they're out of weapons. I think that what Richard has explained, that Russia's winning, and it's very easy to make the forecast of that Russia's going to very rapidly absorb the provinces that it has set out to absorb, because the Ukrainian army has fallen apart and Ukrainian society has fallen apart. So when Richard talks about the whole world understands this obvious military fact that the ultimate solution and resolution of the war that between NATO and Russia in Ukraine will be settled on the battlefield. It's not going to be settled by any bilateral meeting, either by Trump or by Russia and Europe. It'll be settled on the battlefield. That's what frightens the hawks, in the anti-Russian hawks in Europe so much. They know that they've lost. They're trying to somehow depict themselves as, well, what can we salvage from our loss? What can we do to neutralize Russia's success on the battlefield? What can we do to say, well, we need a protection force, we had an army and what's left of Ukraine, just to prevent Russia from attacking it again, meaning for R to put missile bases on so that we can send missiles against Russia, which is the only thing that we are able to do. They're trying to figure out a fallback position, and at the same time, they if they want to discredit Trump and saying Trump has been hypnotized by Putin. He really is Putin's puppet or Putin's zombie under his control. I think that that is what the Financial Times and the German publication Bild says. And I think that this is really the setting. So Putin can say that in view of the fact that they're not going to agree at any conference table while the war is going on. When there's a ceasefire, it's when there's a stalemate. And the two sides will say, okay, it's a stalemate. Let's stop and we can see where this is going. It's not going to go further than it is now. Let's just stop and draw the line so that neither of our armies are going to have our citizens killed. But as Richard's explained, and I think all of your guests on your show have explained, this is not a stalemate. This is a rout. Finally, the dam has broken, and the Ukraine army is lost. The whole project, promised by the CIA, promised by the congressional advisors, promised by Biden, and promised by Trump in his first term, that somehow this war is going to destabilize Russia's economy. It will overstrain it. It'll be a repeat of the Afghan war. The Russia is going to overstrain it. It'll collapse. The population will revolt, and there will be a regime change. All of that is a fantasy. And the problem is how to convince the victims of this fantasy, its perpetrators, who are smoking their own dope, can come to accept the fact that not only is the fantasy over, but their hope of somehow retaining something from this this fantasy is not going to work. Russia can say to Trump, we know that you have a problem with Europe. We're on your side, not Europe's side. We don't want Europe. There's nothing that Europe has that we want, and we're willing to give up all the hope of selling our oil and gas, raw materials, or other things to Europe. We have no desire for European investment in our country. You can have Europe's energy market for your liquefied natural gas. That's the only market. We're willing to stay out of Europe and leave that Western Europe. Leave that as your sphere of influence. You're all free for it. You can sell all the arms you want to the NATO countries, but just realize that once these arms are bought by Europe, they're European arms, not American arms anymore. And any attack on Russia's territory is going to be met by a counterattack on the attacker. The attacker is not Ukraine. The attacker is MI6 and the CIA and the American troops there, but not the American mainland. The attacker is France. The attacker is Germany. German military arms producers, Rheinmetall, et cetera, they will be under attack. The American troops in Germany and in England will be under attack because they're part of the English and German attack on Russia, but not America itself. This is going to be the nitty-gritty of everything. And Putin can quip to Trump that this is the most peace-oriented thing that the United States can do. Avoid a U.S.-Russia exchange of bombs. You can have Europe as your sphere of influence. And that really is the only power that the U.S. economy has. Richard's quite right, as both of us have been describing how the American empire is in decline. America has declared war on 85% of the world's population, and the world's population has just said, okay, we're withdrawing. You can sanction us, not trade with us. We're happy to reorient to trade without you. Brazil is now replacing America's soybean farmers. The American agriculture's in trouble. The rest of the world, 85%, can live by itself, letting the United States have the one area in which the American empire still has room to expand into Europe. And when Secretary Hesketh the other day said, we're looking at all of the assets. The monetary reserves of Europe are really going to be part, we're going to make a national investment fund, and we're going to tell Europe to invest their reserves in American industry to try to rebuild industrialization here. Well, Trump can sort of applaud Trump and say, this is a wonderful idea. Let them try to do that. Well, of course, it's not possible to reestablish industrial viability in the United States for the reasons we've discussed before. America is no longer an industrial capitalist country. It's a finance capitalist country, and finance has no interest at all in industrializing the economy as a means of getting rich, when it, you can get rich much quicker by rent seeking, by financial engineering, by indebting the economy of the bottom 90% to the wealthiest 10%, by achieving monopolies, especially in information technology and computer chips. I think what Russian can do is speed the parting guest, applaud America's ability to revive its economy at Europe's expense, and say, you go your way, we'll go our way. We will not interfere with whatever you want to do in Europe. We surrender to you, the European market. And they'll laugh to themselves as they realize that what they've got is the part of the world, the 85% that has a growing market. That basically is the context for all of the negotiation. I don't think there's anyone on the American side that is telling that to Mr. Trump, but that's why our show, your show, has such a large readership.
Let me add a little bit here. We learned from the Vietnam War that for months, probably for years, the American government was divided about ending that war and departing. And the reason was that they were losing. But nobody wanted to be the president or the political party in charge to make the final statement, okay, we're leaving, we lost. And so we saw those amazing photographs of the few Vietnamese who could hang on with their hands to the bottom of the departing helicopter as it left Saigon in 1975. We then had the same delay at the cost of countless American lives over when to leave in Afghanistan, as it became clear that the Taliban had defeated the United States. Oh, excuse me, the coalition of the dubious. The willing. Wow. You know what's going on now? A debate about how to handle the comparable situation in Ukraine. People ask, why the focus on a ceasefire? Because a ceasefire, just a word, is a lot less painful than defeat. And you can say, we accomplished a ceasefire. Then you can hype it as though we forced it on them and all the rest of it. It would be wonderful for the Europeans who are so afraid of their own people. What will happen to the mass of the European? Ask yourself. If they have to watch the next 6 months or a year of the final defeat of the Ukrainian shell army, which is all that's left, that's going to make those who have been critical all along wave their fingers and say, we could have avoided this war from the beginning. We could have agreed in Minsk, or we could have agreed in Istanbul to end it much earlier. But our leaders said, stay with it. And so now we are horribly in debt. We are horribly economically hurt. They already admit that the cost of energy is off the chart in Europe and therefore damaging them competitively. Therefore, those particular leaders that have been pushing, of course they're pushing now. Their own survival is at stake. Their survival politically cannot handle a defeat. It'll be too much, and it will lead to their people saying, since Russia has never attacked any of them, work out an arrangement. Rearrange the security architecture of Europe That's a better bet. Otherwise, we risk here having happened what they just suffered in their horribly defaced country of Ukraine. We don't want this. A ceasefire now is better for the West than all of that. Or to say the same thing as bluntly as I know how. We are watching the demand for a ceasefire from the side that's losing. Of course they want a ceasefire. Will they then rebuild? Sure they will. Will the Russians rebuild? Sure they will. Will we then have the same issue? Sure we will. That's why it's not a solution for the Russians. That's why Putin keeps saying, no, 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 not a ceasefire. We have to go to the root causes. Because otherwise there is no end to this. That's what but the West will take that. Because they're facing, we lost, we got a ceasefire, or kick the can down the road. And given the courage of the leaders of Europe and the United States, kicking the can down the road would be my number one bet. Last point. Here's a deal Mr. Putin might make. Give the West a ceasefire, but hedge it around with qualifiers, conditions, exemptions to make it do what the Russians want it to do. That way you can have the saving face for Mr. Trump. I got a ceasefire. And the Russians able to do 90% of what they had intended to do. Is that possible? I'm no military expert, and I don't know what the conventions of diplomacy like this are. But it wouldn't be the first time that between the public parts of an agreement and the secret parts of an agreement, such things are agreed to. That has happened before. That could happen again.
Well, Michael, when I look at two sides, the United States and Russia, I see Vladimir Putin after the meeting between Steve Witkoff and Vladimir Putin, he talked with his partners. He talked with India, China, and literally with all the countries of BRICS. It seems that he knows whatever happens in that meeting, he knows that he informed his partners and they're prepared for any outcome. On the part of the United States, you don't see that sort of unity between the United States and Europeans. They're totally different. Their position is totally different on Ukraine because Europeans don't want to, it seems to me they want a continuation of the conflict in Ukraine. They don't want to put an end to the conflict as soon as possible, which it seems that at least Donald Trump is talking about it. How do you see the way the pressures on these two leaders going to the meeting? Do you feel that the United States would somehow declare that it was all Russian fault if they don't achieve a substantial outcome in this meeting? It seems to me, because Donald Trump was talking about if it is successful, they're going to have a second meeting. Then Zelensky going to come in. This is amazing to me because Zelensky is not interested in reaching a deal. Your take on that?
Trump says that any meeting he has with anyone is successful. Any meeting goes wonderful and Trump is won. How is he going to spell this out? You mentioned that what Russia wants to talk about are the causes. Trump can find some refuge in saying, we talked about the broad setting and how we can settle much more than Ukraine. We can settle the whole relationship between America and Russia and maybe even America, NATO and Russia. But the second meeting that will come up, and I'm sure this is going to be raised today, is a warning, is it's not only the causes that Russia wants to talk about. The Russian NATO antagonism goes far beyond Ukraine. We mentioned it, it's extended into the Caucasus with Azerbaijan and Armenia, with the U.S. control of the Zangarudz corridor, threatening Iran.
Is Zangezur, Michael.
Zangezur
corridor.
Zangezur. Okay, thank you. Threatening Iran and China's Belt and Road trajectory. So Russia is going to say, let's deal with, they're going to be, NATO is attacking us, and with U.S. support on many fronts. NATO's attacking our tanker trade in the Baltics. If they attack our tanker trade, we're going to have to wipe out their naval ports from which they're attacking our naval trade. The MI6 and the CIA, apparently, are engaging in terrorism against Russian oil tankers by putting bombs on the tankers, attaching bombs that explode and sink the tankers. There's been two or three tankers already that have been victimized by the terrorism. I think Russia has to move on that. Russia still has a repertory of attacks beyond Ukraine that NATO have engaged in, such as all of the 12 or 13 biolabs that Ukraine, and I should say that NATO had placed in Ukraine to wage biological warfare on Russia. I think, Russia's strongest position is that NATO is a terrorist organization. America is a terrorist country. And Russia is defending itself. That's how I think Russia is perceiving this and is depicting it to its own people. Obviously, that's not going to be recognized at the meeting, but I'm sure that Russia's going to bring up the fact that in order to settle the crisis that Trump calls the Ukraine crisis, is only an arena, the crisis is the whole orientation of U.S. policy to try to break up Russia ever since the 1991 disaster of the 1990s in Russia. That's really going to be the big picture. The question is, how can they communicate this big picture to the West when none of the Western media or Congress or politicians are acting to explain and familiarizing the West with the things that Richard and I have been talking about so far, and that I think all of your other guests have been talking about for the last few months?
Well, Richard, what Michael said about the Zangezur corridor, it's so much important, because Donald Trump has just, he's bragging about the deal he could cut between Azerbaijan and Armenia. And they're talking about Zangezur corridor, which the new name, Donald Trump, is the new name is Trump's International Route of Peace and Prosperity. It's so amazing that he's... How do you see, Richard? We know that that region is so much important for the security of Iran and Russia both. And with the situation in the Middle East, connecting that to Zangezur corridor, Armenia, Azerbaijan, and what Michael said about this economic communication among Russia, China, and Iran, do you feel that we're going to have the same sort of conflict, somehow similar to what's going on in Ukraine, or somehow differently in different manner? Because Azerbaijan, I don't know if you heard, yesterday Azerbaijan said they're going to send weapons to Ukraine. So far, they didn't do it. And Russia said, you're not going to do this. You know what would be the outcome. It seems that something is boiling up in that region. You're taking that.
Yeah, you know, put yourself, and I ask your audience, put yourself in the position of the United States and give yourself, just as a hypothetical, give yourself the idea, what would we be doing as a nation if we actually could finally admit that the empire is over? What would we do? When we watch that, you know, in the last 6 months, China has established more solar energy than the rest of the world combined in the same period of time. I mean, it's the umpteenth example. How many do you need? They produce the best, cheapest electric vehicles on the planet. They are solving their pollution problem and their solar energy use. They don't need to worry about fossil fuels in the future. They're not going to be using them. That's going to be a problem of the West, making the West fall further and further behind in where new technologies are going. I mean, if you allow yourself for a minute, then what does the dying empire do? The British Empire, that has been dying for longer and is further down the road of what it means, recently, a few decades ago, made war on the Falkland Islands, where there are more sheep than people. And the British, took them a while, they actually won. We're going to meddle in Azerbaijan. Of course we are. As China creates a global pathway, we are going to nickel and dime that effort by being disruptive wherever we can. Can we find a local government that's in trouble and give them a ton of money to help them survive if only they send a few rifles to Ukraine, which will make no difference to the outcome of that war? These are symbolic play games. They are the acts of desperation of a declining empire. That's what this is about. I don't think, you know, I'm no expert in that area, please. I don't make any claim. You know, I can find it on the map and not much more than that. But these are, for me, sign after sign. Europe is finished. They have to come up with a way to overcome their disunity. There's no sign of it. They have to come up with a way to catch up with the new technology of the world, which is coming from China and the United States still. And they're not doing that. Where are they? Where's their future? Nowhere. They're desperately trying to hold on. They spent the last 75 years being the dutiful vassal of the United States. They don't know how to break out of that. They are terrified, both personally, because the careers of all their leaders were tutelage in all of that, and because it is hard to come up with a new plan. Your colonies are gone. Your social position in the world is gone. Your economic dominance is reduced to finance, as Michael shows us. And even that is being contested increasingly. When the world thinks of replacing the dollar, they're not looking at the euro. Right? It's important to understand they face the worst of all. Not a decline, but a real end of their five centuries of dominance in the world. And they don't. And look at their leaders. If ever you had a collection of leaders inadequate to their historical moment, they are there right now for us to look at. You know, and Mr. Xi Jinping and Mr. Modi and Mr. Putin, they're just riding on the wave as it goes up and enjoying the ride, much as the Europeans enjoyed the ride up. as the Americans did. I think that's the way to understand all of this, the Ukraine war and everything else. When that Ukraine war stops and it begins to be possible in Europe to talk about what that war cost the Europeans and what they got, the leaders who are held responsible. Look, it's hard for Tony Blair to move around England. He stopped being Prime Minister of England many years ago. But what's remembered is that he lied over and over again to justify England playing a minor role in the invasion of Iraq. He had repeated weapons of mass destruction, knowing nothing. He relied on the British intelligence, who either knew nothing or didn't tell him, and I don't know which is worse. He's not remembered well. No one does. The man is barely tolerated. And I think those are signs. The British are our future. We're the next empire. They're going down. We are now going down. And it's not pretty. And when you go down, more than ever, you need the symbolism that, oh, no, you're still strong here, or no. And if I could conclude, that's Donald Trump. He's the cheerleader. I'm powerful. I can hit the world with tariffs. I can hit the bad guys with sanctions. I will decide. I heard him this morning. If he doesn't get the right response when he meets Mr. Putin in Alaska, well, you know, he'll say this is not adequate and that meeting will come to an end. Look at the way the man talks. He talks like he's the man in charge. He's not the man in charge. But he does for the American people the theater of the man in charge. And when you can't be the real thing, going to the theatrical replica is very attractive.
I think Trump is trying to just cover his ass when he says he's going to walk out, meaning he knows that it's the Russians who are not going to surrender. Regarding Europe, yesterday it was announced that the Alternative for Deutschland now polls higher than the Christian Democrats and Christian Socialists and the Social Democratic Party in Germany. So Merz is now been essentially rejected by certainly the German public. But the United States is left only with one diplomatic lever, one weapon, and that's the ability to disrupt. And that's what Trump was using for his tariffs. He can disrupt other countries if they don't agree to live in the short run and agree to what Trump is offering in the short run, avoid unemployment and avoid a disruption of trade because they really can't envision a long run. Well, the last 6 months have shown the BRICS countries and the Global South that, it's not that hard to reorient our trade. Look at Brazil and China. Look at the other countries that have been replacing the American market with others. Part of the disruption, of course, is, as you pointed out, climate. The U.S. position is to support oil and fossil fuels as the wave of the future and to oppose wind power, solar power, water power, everything that is not oil. For the reason I brought up the Zangezur corridor is because this is an attempt to disrupt not simply Russia in the Caucasus, but Iran itself. Nima, you and I were talking before the show, and I wish you could explain what you explained to me about the role of Azeri in Japan. I think the Americans are hoping that if they can stir up a fight between the Azerbaijan and Russia, that somehow this will have an effect on the Azeri province of northern Iran, which is what 50 years ago at the Hudson Institute, American military people were talking about how to break Iran into its component parts. What's the relation between Azerbaijan and Iran as you see it?
Yeah. Azerbaijan was part of Iran before all of this happening. That's why we have Azerbaijan in Iran. We have the country called Azerbaijan. But they were somehow hoping that they can bring these two parts together, make some sort of connection between the Azeri part of Iran in the northwest of Iran and the Azeri, the Azerbaijan, the country. But what has happened in the last, I would assume, in the last 20 years, the last 10 years, somehow the conflict that Iran was facing and the way that Azerbaijan was behaving, and lately with the attack on Iran, Israeli attack on Iran, going to Azerbaijan, then attacking Iran, it's somehow these people have no, you know, they were, before they were somehow feeling that because of the language, they're talking the same language, the cultural issue, the cultural connection between the two. But right now it's all changed. And I don't know if the people in the United States, those people, policymakers, understand what's going on in Iran. It's some sort of, I would say, unity. It's unity is coming from within the society. You have, in Iran, many people would assume that nobody knows, many people don't know what is going on in Iran. Iran is, it's some kind of rainbow. You have Azeris, Kurds, Lurs, you know, Persian, all together for centuries, for thousands of years, they were living each other. And many people don't know that we have a lot Jewish people in Iran. Go, you know, it's all amazing to me when I talk with people, they feel that Iran is somehow, you know, it's all political. Iran doesn't like this and that. But what, when it comes to Azeri and Azerbaijan, Michael, I think the main issue for Iran is the security and the connection between Iran and Russia and China. Because Iran has warned Armenia as well, said, you're going to in that direction, you're going to disconnect us from Russia and China. You're going to face a lot of issues. We're going to go after you. We're going to talk to you differently. And it seems to me somehow the Trump administration feels that they can do something in that region. But it's not just about Iran. It's about, as you've mentioned, Iran, China, and Russia. I don't see they can somehow manipulate the way that they did in Ukraine, because Armenia and Azerbaijan are aware of what's going on, because Russia was talking with Azerbaijan. Iran is communicating with both Azerbaijan and Armenia. If you go to that direction, we're going to teach you to behave, because we want a better relationship with you. This is the way that I see what's going on in that region. Your understanding could be helpful, Michael, in the way that you see economically how the economic issues and the connection between the countries would finally decide about the security of the region.
Well, if I could just jump in. Here's a very short lesson in geography. They're all over there. Of course, the Azeris, the Armenians, they have to come to terms with their immediate environment, which is Russia, Iran, the Belt Road Initiative, China, India. Why in the world, over time, would they want to be the lonely outpost of the United States, a dying empire? You don't make deals that way. Maybe temporarily, maybe this leader or that leader, but the longer run, that's not going to happen. Just like it's going to take longer before Guatemala, Costa Rica, and Panama work something out with the Chinese and the Russians. That's going to be a slow, careful, because they have to deal with their enormous vulnerability to the United States, in the way that Mexico and Canada also have to. It's not that they can't do some things. The Canadians are now opening up relations with China very quickly and very importantly, with aluminum and lumber and all kinds, very important. But still, they work very slowly and they're very nervous about what they have to come to terms with you know, a 2,000-mile border or 3,000-mile border with that country. And I think you're going to see the same thing. The logical next step for countries in the Caucasus is either to ally themselves with the BRICS, which some are doing, or to become one of those countries that plays the two, the dying empire and the arriving empire, against each other. We're everybody's friend. We'll send the next mission that we need to help build a railroad in our country. We'll send it to London and New York. But instead of coming home after that, they will fly directly to New Delhi or Beijing or, you know, that. And who's going to give us the best deal? I already have noticed and followed, because of my interest in Africa, that many of the railroads being built in Africa now are being built by the Chinese. But that was after those people sent a mission to the West, said, we want help for this railroad. What can you do? And they got offers. And then they went to the other side and they got offers. And guess what? The offers coming from the BRICS. You know, I want to remind everyone, the BRICS is now a bigger, richer unity of economic strength than it are the G7. So, of course, it should surprise no one that a better deal can often be offered by the other side. And so the railroad will be built by the Chinese. And I think that's going to be the strategy in the end, that Armenia will likely follow, that Azerbaijan will likely follow, and that even if the politics opens up, Iran itself will follow.
There's a social dimension that Nima alluded to that explains the West's failure to understand what's happening. The West has always been strongly racist. The American government officials cannot imagine a multi-ethnic society. You're having Trump basically declare war on immigrants. You've had the whole of American history being a fight against the indigenous population, including my ancestors in the Chippewa tribe. All of the Western colonialism has been racist, and the last thing that they could even imagine is multi-ethnic. Russia is a multi-ethnic society and multi-religious. The Iran is multi-ethnic. And I've known many Iranian Jewish leaders who have prominent positions in Iran. They don't have any problem being multi-ethnic. It's the West that is trying to play the race card, the ethnic divisions, trying to stir up and set and interfere with the whole rest of the world's multi-ethnic a bit. And I've got to say, this is what Roman Christianity is all about. It's to hate people who are not part of your group. This is what made the Roman Church so break away from the Orthodox Christian Church in Constantinople, in the East, in all of the other five patriarchates. Basically, the Romans declared any population that's not part of our religion is the enemy. That's the whole background of the mentality that you're seeing in Israel today and any of the whole Western sphere. They don't understand the West. And in a way, this intolerance of multi-ethnicity is a cohesive factor in organizing the rest of the world, saying, we can work together. The only people that we cannot work with are the West that do not accept us because we're not their ethnicity. We're not their religion. And they've declared a religious and almost ethnic war. That's the whole history of the British Empire, the French Empire, the German Empire, the American Empire going, and the whole West going back to medieval times.
Yeah, and it is. I'm struck only because my early work as an academic was in the British Empire, particularly the British Empire in Africa. And I was always amazed. They really did have a manual or a recipe book. And it was to find what they would call in Africa tribal differences, and they would then play them. This part of the country where there was this tribe would be set against the other. That's how they divide and conquer was their rule. Divide and administer was their rule. And so, yeah, they've done that with, you know, the imperialism and colonialism just gave them a global platform upon which to practice their politics. And I'm sure there are residues of it all now.
Well, Ukraine is a residue of that.
Yes, Ukraine as well. That's right. Yeah. Ukraine as well. And it is, I don't want to lose it, and I'm not preaching to you because you need it, but there is a part of this that is unspeakable, and yet we must speak it. The people of Ukraine have been sacrificed here. You have seen the United States, the Europeans, the Russians, and the Ukrainian leaders work together to ravage that country. I mean, look, here's the only thing one can say that against that, which I know people won't want to hear, but at least the Russians have not done to Ukraine what the Israelis have done in Gaza. They didn't go in and destroy Kiev, you know, the center of the other society, and reduce it to rubble. They haven't declared their goal to be having the Ukrainians out of Ukraine, which is, if you think about it, an extraordinary moment, because we are constantly looking at the Ukraine war with the Gaza story in our minds as if they were each a lens for looking at the other. And, you know, we get upset, and I understand it, if a Russian missile gets to Kiev and there are a dozen people killed. But they don't kill in a month what is killed in two days in Gaza. And in the end, not that the numbers are crucial, but the scale of what's going on, it's a message to the whole world of what vulnerability we are on from ourselves as a species, that some of us could be doing what we are doing, could sit there now 3.5 years into the war in Ukraine of this endless destruction of their, you know, electric facilities, the things that have been the targets of Russian response, or by that matter, targets of the Ukrainians, because as people don't seem to understand, the territory captured by Russia, which is now 25%, more or less, if I understand correctly the map, the Ukrainians bomb that area. So now the Ukrainians that have been pushed to westward are bombing their own country that was taken by the Russians. So that in those areas, you have destruction the Ukrainians have caused to their own, what they want to think of as their own country.
Well, then to the Ukrainians, the Russian speakers are Gaza. And to America, the whole rest, 85% of the rest of the world is Gaza. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Richard and Michael. Great pleasure, as always.
We'll have to do a post-mortem or whatever, post-whatever, next Thursday to see how we stack up as people who at least approach the question of looking into the future, which I know we all understand none of us can predict.
If there is a next Thursday.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to laugh to keep from crying.
See you soon. Bye-bye.